Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to New Books in Hindu Studies, which is part of the New Books Network. I am your host, Shandeep Saha, Associate Professor of Religious Studies at Athabasca University, a research and distance learning university dedicated to breaking down barriers to learning by offering open and flexible educational options across the disciplines. For a range of courses and programs offered at AU, please check out our website, www.athabascau.ca. And today, I am so happy to have Dr. Dione Moody on the podcast. She's the author of a book published in 2018 by Oxford University Press entitled The Making of a Modern Temple, Kalighat and Kolkata. Dione, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
Tell our listeners just a little bit about yourself, what you teach, where you teach, what your areas of research are.
So I teach at the University of Oklahoma. I'm an assistant professor of religious studies. So I teach courses on general overviews of religious studies. I teach our theories and methods course, and I also teach courses on Hinduism and religion and nationalism in India. And my research, very broadly, I look at the various forms that Hinduism takes in modern India. And very specifically, I focus on the city of Kolkata. As you know, Kolkata is really ground zero for Indian modernity. And so it's an especially fascinating place to study modern Hinduism.
Well, that's a perfect way to launch into my next question. And is what drew you to the particular topic of Kalighat?
Yeah, so I've been visiting Kalighat ever since 2002, so for a very long time. And it's always a place that's really fascinated me. And when I got into my graduate work and I learned about Kolkata, and I learned about the Bajralok in Kolkata. You know, this is a place that really fostered the production of an Indian middle class, what we call a middle class, sometimes confusingly, but it's that an elite set of Indians that was produced through basically Western educational institutions in the 19th century in this capital of the British Empire in India. And so this is a place where people like Tagore and Vivekananda are highly revered. Hindu reform movements basically shaped Hinduism in that time period in such a way that quote-unquote good Hinduism was basically monotheistic, anti-iconoclastic, anti-ritualistic. And yet, here's this temple Kalighat, not just a temple, but a temple dedicated to the goddess Kali, who has, a garland of skulls around her neck. She's holding a severed head and a bloodied sword. Right. And so that's really what the book tries to get at. Like, how do you think about the site of the Bengali Bajralok and wow, Kali worship? And Kalighat, by the way, is a place where animal sacrifice takes place on a daily basis. So that juxtaposition was something that really fascinated me. And when I tried to learn more about it in an academic context, I realized, wow, there's really not much going on there. But when you're looking for a dissertation project, that's exactly what you want, something that hasn't been worked on before.
So what do we know, say, about the construction of the temple, because and the historical origins of the temple in Zimbabwe, because there's the, first of all, it might be good just to tell our readers a little bit about what is it, you've talked about it, the temple in terms of Bengali culture, but in terms of its place in Hinduism as a whole, because there is a whole sort of important origin story behind Kali Ka. So what is that origin story for readers who do not know what the sort of cultural religious significance of Kali Ka is to Hindus as a whole? And then what do we know about the historical origins of the temple and its image? Because what I understand about the image, at least, is that the image as we see it now, you know, different aspects of it, like the tongue and whatnot, for example, are part of donations, if I recall, right. that are stemming from the 19th century. So we're not looking necessarily, the image as we see it is not necessarily some sort of ancient pre-19th century image, sure. Or is it?
Yeah. Well, yeah. So, okay. So there's a lot in that set of questions. So theologically, the claim to fame for this temple, it's that it's a Shakti Peeth. So literally a seat of the goddess. So there's this story about Sati, the goddess whose father Daksha is holding a sacrifice. Her husband Shiva is not invited to this sacrifice, and she is so upset by this that she goes and she immolates herself on the fire of in her father's ritual. And Shiva is so distraught by this that he picks up his wife and carries her burnt body all over the quote-unquote world, which happens to be South Asia in this imagining. And he is so distraught that his dance of destruction threatens to ruin the entire universe. And so Shiva comes along and cuts off little bits of her body with his chakra, his round circular weapon. And everywhere her body lands, a manifestation of the goddess springs up. Her four right toes, minus her big toe, apparently landed in what is now Calcutta. And that is the origin story of Kali Ka. So it's a Shakti Peeth. It's where her body literally is. And it also connects Kali Ka to a whole set of other goddess temples across South Asia. So people will say, okay, so there's Dakshineshwar in the northern part of the temple, which, by the way, when I talk about my project, especially to academics, they're like, oh yeah, I know a famous Kali temple in Kolkata. It's Dakshineshwar. It's where Ramakrishna is. Right?
Right. And, I was going to ask you about that. Maybe we'll bring that up in a bit, because I'm sort of wondering that there is a whole, I wouldn't call it a triangle, but I mean, there's a trio of big temples there. There's four. I mean, there's Dakshineshwar, Kali Ghat, Tarapeeth and Tarakeshwar, which is admittedly a Shaivite mm-hmm. temple, but still mm-hmm. it's mm-hmm. I'm sort of wondering about the relationship between those four, but we'll get back to that in a minute. So keep going.
Yeah. So what my interlocutors will say is all of those other temples are important, right? But if you want the real thing, you've got to go to Kali Ghat. One person put it this way, you know, okay, so God's everywhere and there are churches everywhere, but Rome is special and there are mosques everywhere, but Mecca is special.
I've never heard that. That's great.
Right? I mean, this is a pretty major analogy to be making, a pretty striking one. And he says, Kali is everywhere, but Kali God is special. Okay, so this is a really, really important temple. Now, what we know about the historical origins of the temple are actually very, very little. We know that it reference to Kali Ghat is made in some versions of the late 15th century-ish text, the Manusha Mongol, but it didn't really become a popular site of worship until the 17th and really the 18th century, kind of ironically, because the British hated this place. It like epitomized everything that was wrong with Hinduism for them, but it became a lot more popular when they built the infrastructure that made travel to and from this site a lot more feasible. And as you say, it is, okay, so we don't, okay, so the temple that stands today was built in 1809. Construction took place between 1799 and 1809 by the Shabana Roy Chowdhury family, who were the zamindars of this area. They built that temple. We know that it was replacing an existing temple, but we don't know for how long the previous temple stood. So one assumes that the black stone that is the murti of Kali, the Svayambhu murti of Kali in the temple, one assumes that that predates, the 1809 temple. I'm sure that that is the case. But yes, as you say, all of the accoutrement, the tongue, the crown, the bangles, all of those things have been added to Kali incrementally over time. The arms.
So my next question then is why Kali Ghat? And I think that before that, it's probably worth talking about sort of the big three, so to speak, Kali temples in Bengal, because we have Kali Ghat smack dab in Calcutta. We had the Kanishka associated with Ramakrishna Vivekananda and the Ramakrishna Mission outside Calcutta. And then further away, we have Tarapeeth, right? And you would think that maybe Tarapeeth of the three might be more of the focus, because we're talking cremation grounds, people meditating on skulls, so the legends go. We have the eccentric Bama Kappa over there, and then of course we have the image itself. But yet, why wouldn't something with that type of atmosphere be the focus of this type of discourse? But yet, it's Kali Ghat. Is it Kali Ghat just because it's Kali Ghat is the because it's in Calcutta, so it's visible.
Yeah.
And the Kanishka, I guess, is just already fashioned in the lines of Bhadrog values by virtue of the Ramakrishna Mission.
Right. So, yeah. I mean, I think one of the answers is absolutely it's in Kolkata. And so what I do in my first chapter is I look at the ways that late 19th century, so 1891 to 1902, about late 19th century Bengali Hindus, the way that they write the historical account of Kali Ghat. Like I said, we don't actually know very much of the historical account. But I look at four authors in that chapter who do a great deal of historical analysis of Kali Ghat. They completely disagree about all aspects of the temple and its history. And yet what they're doing in those works is that they are staking a claim to the city that says this is Kali's Kshetra. This is Kali's sacred land. And the reason that is particularly important is because in the 19th century, you've got British historians who are writing historical narratives of the city. They'd written in the city before, but this is the point in time where they're writing about the city, the origin stories of the city. And to pick up a history book on Calcutta today is to read the same kind of narrative. This is a city built by and for the British. It was founded by Job Charnock, who landed on its shores in 1690. The city in 1990 actually celebrated its 300th year anniversary, marking Job Charnock's arrival as the beginning of the city, right? So what these historians are doing, these Bengali Hindu historians are doing, that's so powerful and empowering, is that they're saying, no, this isn't yours. This is ours. This is the founder of Calcutta is in fact Kali. And it wasn't, you guys and your broad boulevards and your giant buildings that make this place great. It's all of those Hindus who Kali has been attracting to the city, those devout Hindus who Kali's been attracting to this area since quote unquote time immemorial, that make this place great.
But then how do those guys actually go about reconciling sort of the Brahmo Samaj Hindu reform movement and that sort of strain of discourse that's going on with what they're trying to accomplish with Kali, as you said, where sacrifices are occurring on a daily basis, right? Like that's a big balancing act that they have.
Absolutely. And it's fascinating to see the way that they do it, because what they say is that values such as monotheism and nonviolence have actually been present at the temple since time immemorial. So they'll say things like, well, there's only one God, but Kali is a manifestation of that God. Or they'll say, sure, animal sacrifice happens at the temple, but it's not something that the founders of the temple really did. That's something that tantricas came in and did, or that's something that, people from the villages do, but that's not, really what the temple is about. So they'll admit that these things exist, and they'll admit that people who don't know as much will interpret the temple in different ways than they do. But they will read a lot of those values onto the temple and write them into the temple's history.
But then that's, again, there's then that opens up a whole other can of worms for them, doesn't that, in terms of their argument? Because while tantric culture, tantric religious practices are an intimate part of Bengali religious culture, and is it meant to be a critique of tantra as well, or are they just saying that tantra is valid but it isn't being performed properly? And then number two, if it was a case of, you know, villagers do that type of thing, did they ever raise any concerns about having it stopped in the temple if that wasn't part of quote unquote the original temple tradition?
Right. Well, what they will say is, so by the way, I don't think it's a critique of tantra in general. I think that they don't explicitly go there in these texts, but I think that they would think about tantra in a sort of Arthur Avalon-esque kind of a way. So they're not thinking about the kind of nitty gritty of tantra. And so what they'll do is they'll distance themselves from the animal sacrifice. You had a second question, though, that I just flew out of my head. What was the second question?
Oh, yeah. The second question was, if for these early writers that you're talking about, they're saying that, blood sacrifice, the animal sacrifice was not what the original founders intended. It was something that came in later. But then,
why not stop it? So a friend recently said to me, if you get rid of animal sacrifice, you may as well just get rid of Kali worship altogether. which is this one particular view, but animal sacrifice is so deeply tied to the worship of Kali. And the thing is, it has been stopped at all of the other Kali temples in the city, except for maybe once a year on Durga Puja. The last day of Durga Puja, they'll sacrifice a goat. But at Kali Ghat, it happens daily. So I had one of the priests at the temple, one of the Shivayats, tell me, my guru is at Balur Math, Ramakrishna's, Vivekananda's place near Dakshineshwar. And since Dakshineshwar no longer allows animal sacrifice, he asks me to sacrifice goats at Kali Ghat for him. So Kali Ghat becomes even more important in terms of animal sacrifice, since it's not going on elsewhere.
Amazing.
Right. So there are lots. The third chapter of the book looks at renovation projects. So people who are middle class citizens who are trying to clean up the temple, clear out the temple, get rid of the beggars and the hawkers and the pandas, some of those ritual guides who guide people through the temple. And they're also trying to clean up the physical image in terms of, cleaning up the floors and getting rid of blood. They're not seriously calling for an end to animal sacrifice. I think it just wouldn't happen. So what they've done instead is they've built a higher wall around the sacrificial enclosure so that people don't have to see it if they don't want to.
But then how does that work with, say, our colleague Rachel McDermott, who's talking about this softening of Kali, for example, in devotional poetry, right? Mm-hmm. Because, we're going for Rachel's argument, I guess, has been that, the goddess goes from being a fiery sort of bloodthirsty goddess to almost this doll-like sort of domesticated figure in some strands of more modern Bengali devotional poetry. Mm-hmm. And on top of that, I'm vividly coming to mind right now as you're talking to me about this is a poem by, Ghazi Nazrul Islam, one of his very famous devotional songs to Kali, where he's saying that, he's allegorizing everything. So the animal sacrifice is the sacrifice of his vices and so on and so forth to the goddess. So in other words, that it's not the animal sacrifice that's important. It's more about sacrificing all those vices that we have to the goddess so we can become, better devotees or whatever the case may be. And I'm still trying to reconcile in my mind then what is it that's giving Kali Ghat sort of its durability here, that it's able to sort of withstand that type of other discourse, yeah, which wants to completely downplay that type of religious, yeah, practice? And, you know, like, how does that even work?
The lovely thing about ritual, right, is that you can interpret it however you would like to. And so there are plenty of people who go to the temple. There are plenty of people who go to the temple and who say, you know, I'm not going to physically kill a goat, but I am going to, yeah, exactly as you say, I'm going to sacrifice my ego to the goddess, and that's my sacrifice. There are people who will sacrifice a gourd or a coconut instead. So there are all various ways that you can reimagine sacrifice that don't necessitate animal sacrifice. And yet there are plenty of people, and there's enough demand, sometimes, as I said, even secretive demand, for it to happen, that I just don't see it going anywhere. But by the way, throughout all of this, you know, in terms of Rachel McDermott's thesis, they're all of the devotees are approaching Kali as Ma. So I really think that softening has absolutely happened. That has happened, and animal sacrifice still happens. Both of them are going on at the same time.
So there's just an amazing sort of tension here that just seems to somehow sort of, it always seems to keep its mm-hmm. balance. And I don't know if you think that's in part just when you're talking to your devotees at Kali Ghat, for example, that, again, I'm drawing again upon my knowledge of Shakta Padavali, mm-hmm. of Shakta devotional poetry, where the goddess can be everything.
Right. Exactly.
You know, the goddess can be gentle one moment, can be fierce the next, can be in a good mood one moment and really in a bad moment the next. Will accept just all she wants is a jabba phool, the hibiscus that's considered sacred to her. But the other moments, I've heard songs where she's saying that, you know, if you become a widow from dancing on Shiva's body, how are we going to, you'll have to eat meat, you have to be vegetarian. So if that happens, how can we continue with the animal sacrifice? It's like sort of this interesting sort of tension, I would think. I mean, is that what they say, that mother's everything to everybody? So
in fact, this calls to mind when I was talking about this tension you're talking about in a class of undergraduates, and I had a student say to me, what tension? My mom is fierce. She says to me all the time, I brought you into this world, I can take you out of this world. being loving, yes. Right, I know. But being loving and fierce don't have to be at odds with one another. They can be intertwined parts of our notions of the maternal.
I will say, we were talking about this before we hit the record button on the interview, about these legal wranglings in Kali Ghat, and I just found this so fascinating because I could draw so many parallels with my own research on Pushti Maharaj. So first of all, what are the nature of the wranglings? So for our audience who don't know about this, and, does this really mark a turning point for the image of the temple as a whole? I mean, it was kind of the sense that I got from the book that these legal rulings kind of set Kali Ghat in terms of its public persona as an institution on a different.
Yes, different world. For sure. I'm really glad that you like that second chapter. In some ways, it is the most complex because I'm sorting through hundreds of pages of legal documents. But it's also, it really is the crux of the book. And so what happens in the early 20th century is that these notions of orderly bureaucracy are brought to bear on the temple, and a notion of a critique of the priesthood is also brought to bear on the temple. And Kali's proprietors, her shivayats, her Brahmin priests, are taken to court because it is said that they are pocketing Kali's money. You know, all of these devotees, this is becoming a really popular temple. All of these devotees are coming to the temple from all over the country, all over the world. And look, these priests are pocketing that money. They're using it to make themselves rich. And so what the courts say, and this is at the district and then state and then actually the national level, this reaches the Supreme Court of India in 1961. What they say is, yeah, we should have some sort of ruling that would mean that the priests don't make a huge amount of money. And this rests on the idea of what's called juristic personality. So technically, yeah, this is this really interesting legal fixture, legal term, right? Yeah. That the income that comes to the temple is literally Kali's money. The goddess Kali owns that money. However, just like another, you know, person in society who can't take care of their worldly affairs, you know, an elderly person or a child or someone like that, they need other people. In this case, they need human proprietors to take care of that money. So the money is technically Kali's. So then the conversation is, okay, well, who controls Kali's money? So the Shivayats would say, and the Shivayat literally means one who serves. So these are the people who are the Brahmin proprietors of the temple. They say, well, Kali entrusted us with the both the responsibility and the privilege of managing her finances, as well as everything else that goes along with the temple when she asked us to be their, her priests. And the court said, well, that may be well and good, but the money shouldn't only be going to what you think it should be going to. It should be going to take care of Kali. You can have an income, but then the rest of the money should go to things like charitable causes, religious talks, renovations. And they went a step further. They said, you know, this is a temple that is used by so many members of the public that this should not be considered a private temple anymore. This should be considered a public temple. And so they overstepped the initial complaint that was brought to the court that was about the division of Kali's assets. And they declared Kali got a public temple. And what this does, and this is why it's such an important part of the book, is it it changes the very purpose of the temple in the eyes of the law. So whereas it used to be the case that the purpose of the temple was to care for Kali, and to facilitate devotion between Kali and devotees and to have Kali's needs taken care of, it's now the case that the purpose of the temple is to take care of the public. So the public now is, comprises a temple committee. So members of the Hindu public that are selected by various civic, religious, and educational bodies in the city. So by Calcutta University, by Sanskrit College, and by a number of other groups, appointees by them make up the Kaligat Temple Committee. So this is a public committee that oversees half of Kali's assets. And the priests get the other half of the assets. Now, then the courts, when they said that the money had to be spent on things like charitable causes and religious talks and renovations, they're not saying, well, that's what Kali wants. They're saying that's what the public needs, right? And then when you see the renovation projects being carried out at Kaligat today through the idiom of the PIL or the public interest litigation, again, what petitioners are saying is I haven't been directly wronged by a priest at the temple, but it would be a benefit to the public. The public has been wronged by the things that are going on at the temple. And so it needs to be cleaned up, for example. And so the idea that the temple is public actually has these ramifications far beyond what the original petitioner in the lawsuit had in mind.
Do devotees who are watching all of this really care?
Right. That's the question. Well, the answer is yes and no. So definitely I met a number of people who said, like, you know, what renovation efforts or what controversy, what modernization campaigns, you know, I just, you know, it's a crowded temple. I go early in the morning, I give my flower, I give my, you know, 10 rupees and I leave and I say my prayers and I leave and that's it. You know, what's the problem? So certainly there were plenty of people who were saying that. And then there were particular moments where devotees actually did care a great deal. So one example of this is that during the time of my research in 2011 and 2012, there was the Calcutta High Court issued a ban on devotees from entering the inner sanctum of Kaligat. The way that Kaligat operates is that, you know, devotees go into the inner sanctum. You have to wait in a very long line, in a hot, sweaty, crowded line. You wait for a very long time. You get into the very cramped inner sanctum. It's sort of just accepted that people touch the feet of the goddess. So in other parts of India, touching the Murti is a no-no, but here that's what happens. So the idea of banning devotees from entering the inner sanctum would completely take away that credibility. So what happened the next day is you had just a flock of people to the temple and journalists and all sorts of protest groups. And they were saying, some of them were saying, well, you know, we have to touch Kali's feet one last time. This might be the last time in our lives we get to touch Kali's feet. So we have to do it. And others were saying things like, well, Kali must be really upset with us that she has allowed this court ruling to proceed, right? Always giving sovereignty to the goddess for these particular voices anyway. And so they said, so we have to pray to Kali to please have this ruling overturned. Well, as it turned out, that ruling was overturned because it was clearly such a big issue that devotees were really going to balk at it.
This raises kind of another issue about which was really striking for me in the book. And honestly, I never really thought about it this way until I read your book. It's about the agents of modernity in the book. The people who are bringing bear to this. You're talking not just about people in Calcutta. Mm-hmm. This is not just a Calcutta-based issue in a sense. I mean, you have NGOs that have been formed around this. You have NRIs.
Right.
That are involved in part of this discussion of modernity around the temple. You have, and this was the one that really struck me, with that the judges who are making the rulings. And you talk a lot in the second chapter about the judicial activism that's going on in India. So, like, who are these agents? How far do they? Where are they coming from? And how are they all bringing their voices directly or indirectly to bear on the on the shaping of God?
Well, they're everywhere. One of the things that I wanted to do in the book is to, you know, we talk a lot about the Bengali Bajralok, but we don't necessarily look at the, Bengali Bajralok in the 19th century was formed through Western educational institutions. Those Western educational institutions have not stopped operating. And the deeper cultural shifts that occurred at that time in terms of the production of individual subjectivities, all of that is still very much going on. And so it's just that they have different tools at their disposal now. So I one of the points that I'm making in the book is, you know, in the 19th century, what were middle-class actors going to do about Kaligat? There wasn't a conception that they could, you know, take it over and try and, you know, change anything. You know, they could write about it, but that's a very external observer kind of a thing to do. Like you can, anyone can write about anything, right? Well, they had the means to publish their writings, which is what, because they were middle-class. But when the elite takes over institutions of government and the judiciary in independent India, then they are not only the lawyers, but also the judges. They are the city council members. They are the people who run tourism agencies. And so the middle class is now an Indian, an elite, right? So their attitudes are shifting according to the various political and economic spectrums within which they're operating. And they are now the petitioners, but they're also the ones making the rulings. They're the ones who beseech legal actions, but they're also the ones who are adjudicating lawsuits. So this is really the what I'm arguing is that there is a turning point that we're witnessing, that we have been witnessing over the past long century, in which it's not just that middle-class ideas are being brought to bear on the temple, but that the middle classes now control temples, at least in an official way. I mean, the whole fourth chapter is about the fact that, like, a lot of this isn't working. But in an official capacity, the middle classes are have the ability, the legal ability, to run temples now.
So in what way is it not working?
So there's a lot of resistance to what they're doing. So the Shavuots, for example, they will hear the rulings that happen and they'll say, well, you know, we have to wait until there are actually orders and or we have to wait until, you know, there's police action that's going to enforce those orders. So the court, one of my lawyer friends in Calcutta says the courts have the bark but not the bite. If the people on the ground are not willing to abide by those orders, and the people in power are not willing to like send in a police force, which they have not been so far, then change doesn't really happen. And then, of course, there are all of these hundreds. Actually, you know, it must be a couple thousand beggars and hawkers and pundits who operate in this area who just physically refuse to move. And if they physically refuse to move, the sheer number is so overwhelming that, you know, I think there's little that can be done. And I make the parallel in the book to Operation Sunshine, which was a movement to clear all of the hawkers off of all public streets in Calcutta, which worked for about 24 hours because there are just so many of them. And
there's just so many of them.
And frankly, city residents count on their services. And so so even while there might be some, you know, ideal sense of a middle class city where, a city where the middle class gets to do as they please, you know, they're living with lots of other people who don't see it that way and who just refuse to respond.
So when I think about just reflecting on what you're talking about now, is there a sense that there's sort of resistance to some of these changes and whatnot that are, you know, that are being talked about in the courts? Is there part of the resistance on the ground because there's sort of a feeling of a sense like if these things happen, there's a loss of cultural identity going on, or if we renovate the temple this way and do this, there's a sense that we're losing a part of our history? Because sometimes I think what comes to mind are say, for example, some of the Swaminarayan temples in Gujarat, where the original temples over a lengthy period of time have been completely renovated to the point that they don't necessarily look like what they were originally, how they were originally constructed, especially, you know, as, you know, you add the gold roof to it, and then you add the tile to it, and then you add the marble to it. And then the next thing, you know, and then of course you're accommodating a huge number of devotees that are coming in. So the inside, you know, gets air conditioning, gets fans and everything like that. And so, and you see this too with the Shirdi temple and, you know, in Maharashtra as well. And this is part of a lot of my own research on the Pushti Marg is about the same thing, that if we start changing the way the temple looks and we start changing the way this happens, we're losing. It's not about elite modernity or discourse or anything like that. We're just losing 400 years or 500 years worth of tradition.
Right.
This is the way that it always was, and we want to keep it that way as much as possible. Is there that sort of that sense going on with Kali Ghat as well, that that some of the pushback is about we're just losing a sense of who we are as residents of Calcutta or as goddess worshippers?
There is a little bit, you know, in terms of traditions. Say the Shavuots will be very protective of traditions of the temple, and they don't want things to change. In terms of physical appearance, though, you know, this is a little bit of a tricky case, because what really matters at the temple is Kali, that Svayambhu Murti in the center. The temple itself, we know, is not ancient. It was built in 1809. The courts, the Calcutta High Court did at some point during the various lawsuits express some concern that any renovations or cleanup or whatever would, exactly as you say, you know, ruin the heritage of the site. And so they enlisted the help of the Archaeological Survey of India, the ASI. Well, the ASI came and they ruled that there have been so many structures added on to the temple over time that they can't actually determine what even the 1809 structure originally was. And so that actually, it would be hard to make an argument that you're preserving culture. Except the people who are interested in heritage are the middle class citizens who say, we want this to be a bastion of our heritage on the international stage of the city. You know, this is a city that people come to from all over the country and the world. We want, and it even stated this in the lawsuits, we want foreign tourists to be able to come to Calcutta and see something that we're proud of. And we don't only want them to be able to see the Victoria Memorial, which, fascinatingly, this memorial to a person, Queen Victoria, that Bengalis hate, is the most pristinely kept monument in the city. It's right in the center. It's, you know, kept beautiful, shining white, just like the Taj Mahal, which was the original intention. The lawn is vast and beautiful green, and it's always, you know, a perfect inch in height. And so, yeah, we want what they say. They're terribly interested in heritage, and they say we want tourists to be able to come to our city and not just see British history. We want them to see Hindu history.
Wow, that's really interesting. So, underlying your book, because, you know, temple complexes, again, have the bazaar around it, and you have people selling stuff all over the place. And so we have paintings, you have books, you have newspapers. I mean, that's already underlying your book. I mean, did you see, you know, like these type of printed media and whatnot have always been an integral part of furthering the agenda of these sort of different versions of modernity. So, I mean, how much of that did you encounter while you were doing your research? Like, I'm not only talking about historical material, but I'm just talking about when you go into a bookstore, when you go into a, you know, you're walking around and you're seeing a stall that's selling pictures of Gali and books and flowers and stuff like that. I mean, you pick up these books and there's a tour book there that's saying, well, you know, blah, 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 blah. You know, this is not, you know, this is the way that it was, but it would be better if it were this way now. And the temple board's making these sort of changes in this way or whatever it is. Like, do you see that type of stuff sort of as one way through which these sort of discussions of modernity are happening sort of quote unquote on the ground level? I mean, even now with the sort of this large tradition of Gali Ghat painting, I mean, is painting and stuff like that even being used or art being used even nowadays to convey these sort of competing versions of modernity around the temple?
Well, certainly pamphlets proliferate and, you know, like little, like 4x6 kind of little booklets about the temple proliferate. One of the really fascinating things about them is that they always talk about the history of the temple. They always talk about the historical origins. They're usually repeating one of the four stories that I talked about in my first chapter. So they're not necessarily copying, but they espouse one of these various views of the historical origins of the temple. They, of course, tell the Shaktipit story as well. But they're not talking about, they're not producing, maybe that's just all there is to say, they're reproducing these 19th century ideas about the historical origins of the city in this kind of rationalistic historical way. I don't know about paintings, honestly. You know, when you walk around the area where the Patuas operate in Gali Ghat today, it's not exactly booming. You know, they exist and they're producing, various devotional images of Saraswati or Ganesh Durga in some of the kinds of images that you see in Durga Puja pandals, but they're not, they don't have this kind of critique that I'm talking about.
Interesting. So as I think I was mentioning to you earlier, before we recorded the podcast that I was, I've been noticing now that, there's going to be a new television serial being shot around Gali Ghat. I know, cause I've seen this movie at least three times. It was a old 1976 black and white, movie made in Calcutta with a very prominent Bengali stage actors and movie mm-hmm. actors of that time period around the temple that focuses largely around the origin mm-hmm. history of the origin story of the temple and the discovery of the image and so on and so forth. So it's not really sort of like a lot of other Bengali devotional movies where they're trying to encourage pilgrimage traffic towards a particular temple as much as they're talking largely about the manner in which the temple came to be. So is that going to be is that part of the new trend now in the sort of discourses of modernity around Gaudiya? Have you seen anything similar like that through Facebook or Twitter or Instagram? Or what's the new expression going to be around the temple other than just courts and pamphlets and NGOs?
Yeah, no, I think I'm really excited to see this television series. I have to figure out how to get my hands on it. They're still shooting it.
So as far as I can tell that they're still shooting it. So I haven't seen an episode.
Okay. I mean, I just in what you're saying about the fact that it's the historical origins of the city that are the mainstay of that film. And I think that film was based on a book by Obadut, is that right?
I don't remember when I was looking at the credits just last week again. It was just said that it was the great sort of Bengali theater personality, radio personality, Birendra Krishna Bhadra, who, you know, Bengalis all associate with the now legendary Mahalaya program that airs on Akashvani on, you know, at 4 o'clock in the week before Durga Puja. He's the one who compiled the stories.
Wow, interesting.
And then he did all the chanting of the shlokas and so on and so forth. Right. So he's the one who, it seems that he's the one, if I recall correctly, who did the compilation, and then they did it together. And he did that for a lot of Shakta and Vaishnavite devotional movies that were being produced in between the 50s and the 70s.
Okay.
So I think it was him, but I can definitely double check on that.
I mean, it's just fascinating in just what you were saying, that what's being recalled is the historical origins of the temple. And I think that really goes back to the reason that Kali God is important is, of course, because Kali is a central figure in the lives of many Bengali Hindus. But it is also the case that Kali God provides this way of thinking about Calcutta that makes it Hindu, that makes it Bengali and not British. And I think that is a kind of importance that can't be discounted.
No, I was just going to say that my guess is that with a lot of these, like these movies that I've seen in the past were around Tharapit and so on and so forth, is that the emphasis is a cross between telling the story about the temple itself and then at the same time interweaving it with miracle stories of devotees, mm-hmm, either that mm-hmm. They've been loosely based on what the producer claimed are actual accounts, or they're just completely made up stories and they're just claiming, but these are completely imaginary and these are all just part of the dramatic effect that we add to the movie and so on and so forth. So like my guess is that, you know, the new Gaudiya television series, like all the other religious TV series, have adopted this telenovela sort of format. So it's going to be a long 675 episode, television series where I'm not sure how they're going to actually pull this off. But, you know, my guess is that the shift is not just going to be, it will be about the history of the community. Mm-hmm. But I think it's probably going to be about domestic drama, which I think in terms of what you're talking about in terms of modernity and expression of Bengali middle class values will be interesting to sort of see what happens, because you have to have a heroine and you have to have a hero, and there's got to be a large sort of Bhadralok family, even if it's a 21st century family around, you know, that all has to be there to keep people engage for 600 episodes. It's got to be something of a family soap opera or family drama.
I see an article in my future, because I think that would be a really interesting different angle to take on this?
Well, you can live blog about it as every episode comes out.
You can do a live blog
on every episode for however many episodes that this this television company decides to put up on. You can see clips for it on YouTube, actually.
Okay. All right.
So you can get a sense of where they're going to be going with this.
Yeah.
So and when the article comes out, I'll be the first one to read it. I guarantee you. So I'll be keeping my eyes
peeled
for it.
Unless you read it first, and then I would love to read it.
No, you definitely won't be. I'm still too stuck in Pushtimark to even think about anything about Bengali now. So,
can I say one thing before?
Yes.
I just want to make sure that I get this in there. I mean, it's important to me that, you know, when the editors were, the publisher was getting back to me about covers. So I found this beautiful image on Flickr and I tracked down the photographer. His name's Luke Bonici and he lives in the UK. And so I was able, to use his photograph, but they wanted the cover of the book to be a saffrony orange. And
oh, interesting.
Yeah. And I realized from the title, I'm going to get flack from this title of The Making of a Modern Temple in a Hindu City. So I want to make the point that what's happening at Kaligat and what I, because people always ask me, well, is it Hindu as opposed to Muslim? Because that's what everyone expects these days, right? It'll be Hindu as opposed to Muslim.
Interesting.
I argue that the root of this discourse was about anti-colonial nationalism. It was about this is a Hindu city as opposed to a British city. However, and so that's why I did not want a saffron cover. I said, no, you have to make it red, the color of Kali, not the color of the BJP. because it's quite different. It's quite different. But I also make the point in the book that just because the aim of the narrative is to take back the city from the British, the effect of it may in fact be to take back the city for Hindus as opposed to anybody else. And so with such a huge Muslim population, with such a diverse city, yes, this is an anti-colonial, this is a Hindu temple as opposed to, this is a Hindu city as opposed to a colonial city. That's what the authors are saying. But at the same time, does that make Kaligat the image of Calcutta, the image of indigenous Calcutta that erases other religious and non-religious options, right? And so the consequences may in fact be to erase Muslim versions of the city, even though that wasn't the intention. And my interlocutors would be very upset by the sense that what they were doing at Kaligat was in any way anti-Muslim, because they all see themselves as multiculturalists and very cosmopolitan and that kind of thing.
So there's no temple, from the sounds of it, from what you're telling me, there's no ban on as there is on certain temples in India for non-Hindus.
And I've seen Muslims and Sikhs and all,
That's what I meant.
Right.
Okay. Well, I'm glad, and it is quite a wonderful photo. So I'm glad that you were also able to work in the name of your source the photo.
Yeah, you did a great job.
And your point is absolutely well taken, and I'm glad that you brought up that point, because it did not even occur to me.
I expect it to come out in the reviews. I think it will come out in the reviews, but I address it in the book, but it's something that I did want to make explicit in this context too.
Okay, so my final question for you is, after Kaligat, what's next?
Yeah, so I'm moving into what appears to be a very different project, but is actually related in a lot of ways. I'm turning to business schools, and especially elite business institutes, management institutes, in India and particularly in Calcutta, and the ways that Hindu ideas and practices and forms are being brought to bear on management pedagogies. And so the reason that this is similar to Kaligat in some ways is that Indian business schools are basically modeled on American business schools. So when India achieved independence in 1947, you had this Nehruvian model of all of these public sector companies, and it became very clear pretty quickly that India was going to need an elite class of business managers to run all of these corporations.
Right.
So they turned to MIT and Harvard, and they said, okay, what's a world-class business education like? Let's bring that here. So it's the imposition of another form of Western dominance that is producing and has started to produce in the 1990s and the early 2000s, a set of faculty that is rethinking that that dominance and saying, okay, well, is it the case that this is just the best kind of education that exists and so we should use it? Or is it the case that there are cultural factors that determine the ways that, say, Americans do business that we don't necessarily need to follow? What is it that we want to keep and what is it that we want to get rid of? And there's a much smaller segment, and this is a sort of a controversial strand within elite business schools, but there's a small strand that's saying, well, why don't we turn to the Vedas and the Upanishads? Why don't we look at Hindu models of exchange, of the economy, of ideas about investment and return on investment? Why don't we think about those texts, look at those texts to think about an Indian model that might productively temper or even replace an American business model? And so it's another setting of, okay, there's Western dominance and here are some Hindu forms that are being taken up to counter it in really interesting ways. But then the other piece of the first project that I'm picking up on is this sense of how religion and economy are intertwined, because of course at the business schools, they have to train their students to make money and you know, to have productive businesses. Well, interestingly, while I was doing work on Kaligat, what I noticed was that these modernizers were looking at, you know, as I said, the priests of the temple, and they're saying it's really inappropriate that they are making money from the temple. They should not be allowed to profit from Kali. But they're also saying, well, we do want to make this into a tourist site, which would mean we want private companies as well as state bodies to hotels and restaurants booths for the selling of ritual accoutrement. We want people to make money from religion, just not the priests. And so there are all sorts of fascinating ideas about how religion and economy can or cannot intertwine, right? Like rules that are being produced in this moment about how religion and economy can be intertwined. Ideas about religious subjectivities, the role of the corporation in the world-class city, projections of Indian culture that I see happening at Kaligat, but also happening at the business school. So I hope that it will provide some fruitful comparisons there.
Well, I'll be definitely looking forward to that as well. So on that note, I'm going to end the podcast. Dioni, thank you for being on the New Books in Hindu Studies podcast.
Thank you so
much. It was lovely being able to talk about your book, The Making of a Modern Temple in the Hindu City, Kaligat and Kolkata, which was published by OUP, Oxford University Press, in 2018.
Thank you so much.
To our listeners, thank you for joining me on the New Books in Hindu podcast. The podcast is part of the New Books Network, brought to you by Amherst College Press. If you'd like to know more about the New Books Network and the range of podcasts that the network offers, please visit www.newbooksnetwork.com and please subscribe to the network on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever app you use to listen to your favorite podcasts. I'm your host, Shandeep Saha, Associate Professor of Religious Studies at Athabasca U. To learn more about why Athabasca University has been the world's leader in open education, visit www.athabascau.ca. Until next time, thank you for listening and thank you for sharing your day with us.